Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to This is the Place, a podcast series from The Common Magazine on the New Books Network. The Common publishes literature and art with a modern sense of place. I'm Emily Everett, managing editor of the magazine and host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Mira Nair about her essay, The Desire Tree, which appears in issue 24 of The Common, out this week. Mira Nair is the author of Video Stories, which was a Washington Post Best Book of the Year. Her work has appeared in Guernica, The Threepenny Review, Calyx, The New York Times, The Guardian, The Washington Post, NPR's Selected Shorts, and elsewhere. She lives in Jackson Heights in Queens, New York. Mira Nair, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Emily. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
We're so glad you're here. Would you just set the scene for our conversation, describe where you're calling from now?
I am in my bedroom in Jackson Heights, Queens, New York, and I just walked in about an hour ago, and, you know, I was thinking about this podcast, and I was thinking also about how much I love Jackson Heights. You know, it's like the cacophony of it all, the babble, the different languages that come at you, the different people. It is considered one of the most diverse neighborhoods in probably the whole world. So, you know, the moment you step off the train, it's just this like amazing, amazing variety of people from all over the world. And I always love that walk from the train to my house. And it's a beautiful, beautiful day outside the window. It's bright and sort of cold. It's one of those lovely, crisp fall days in New York, which, you know, fall is really the best season in New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a beautiful day today here in Western Mass as well. Yeah, you're making me miss New York. I would love to start off with a reading from your essay. Would you read the first few paragraphs for us?
Sure. Happy to. The Desire Tree. By the time the car stops at the end of the dirt road, we've been jolting along for an hour. Before us is the banyan tree we have come to see. Its giant trunk surrounded by hanging roots, its distant crown shutting out the sky. It is summer in Kerala, and the world is liquid and shimmery with heat. The roads and fields are parched, waiting, suspended in a burning delirium for the moment the monsoon will break. My Aunt Sudha and I have just driven through miles of sun-blasted paddy fields, with the abrupt immensity of the tree makes the light feel shadowed, as if dusk has fallen at noon. A hushed feeling comes over me as the dark, looming presence asserts itself. As the two of us step out of the car, Sudha falls quiet. Her pretty face takes on a devout, absorbed expression. I am not particularly spiritual, but I feel like I am in what the Celts call a thin place, where the boundary and epochs feel porous, and worlds both seen and unseen seem to exist at once. I wonder if Sudha is also experiencing what I am feeling, that sense of being near a mystery, something beyond ordinary understanding.
Thank you for reading that. I love that idea of the thin place. Mm-hmm. For our listeners who may not have read your essay yet, would you describe what the piece is about?
I guess, you know, art is different for everybody, but for me, the piece is about the locus of mystery, I guess, you know, of nature, and this tree that is takes on this like mysterious quality for me, and I'm trying to make sense of it, of that experience for myself. And it's also about grief and coming to an understanding of that grief.
That's great. That's a great summary. What inspired you to start work on this essay? Can you talk about how the first draft came together?
Yes. I guess, you know, the first draft for me was literally started with five sentences. And I have those sentences in my computer. It was literally scribbled. It's like sort of became the heart of the essay. It's about this, just a description of the tree and just the fact that it was like, you know, I felt that it was between earth and sky and how it was rooted in like I felt like the roots went deep down. And then about the houses, you know, like the little wooden houses that I talk about that are hanging from the tree. And just that idea was basically the sort of the seed of the essay. But I had been thinking about the essay for a very long time because that tree would keep coming back to me in some way. And I'm sort of a little obsessed with trees. Yeah, I mean, I don't know why. It's just I've always had like a sort of weird kind of attachment to trees and you know, grew up with a lot of them around me because I used to go home to Kerala, which where my family is from in India. And we have this like a big farm and mango grove. And I spend my childhood tucked up inside on some branches reading a book, you know. So I've had like a very physical kind of relationships with trees. So this tree was, I don't know, it just sort of kept coming back to me and I wanted to write about it. And also that the image of those kind of wooden houses and cradles and all hanging from the branches never went away from my mind. And then when, you know, Sudha died, I had to sort of put it away because I couldn't bear to think about her not being in the world anymore. And then it took a while for me to actually come back to the essay and start thinking about it again.
Yeah, that's very understandable. I'm trying to think for our listeners, how would you describe this tree? I sort of think of it as like a tree, like a hypothetically like a wish granting tree, like wishing in a wishing well or something like that. But can you talk more about that?
The tree itself is like this incredibly giant tree. You cannot see the canopy. I mean, you have to really like go way, way back and tilt your head back to be able to actually look up and see where it ends sort of, you know. You can see the sky in between the leaves, of course, but it's a very, very large tree. And it's in Indian culture, trees are really worshipped. You know, we are our religion. I mean, Hinduism comes from like pagan roots and we are very much situated in nature, in natural things. So trees get worshipped all the time. I mean, stones get worshipped. People pick up a stone from a river, put vermilion, like paint on it and start worshipping it. And that becomes a god, you know. So the trees are always seen as sort of divine in a weird way. And I actually think it has to do with environmental consciousness too. Like if you make a tree a divine thing, you're not going to cut it down, you know. So, but with the banyan tree, it plays a part in the culture very much. It's a gathering place. It's a wish granting place. People tie their wishes to the tree. They sometimes try, you know, in the northern parts of India, they actually tie veils to the tree to hoping to be married. So it's like they interact with the tree in a very, very intimate way. And it's only with the banyan tree. It's not with all trees. The banyan tree has a special place in the culture.
And that's so interesting. I was sort of wondering while I was reading this, do you think that the same people who are hanging, you know, hanging veils on the tree or putting things on the tree to ask for wishes, do you think that they're sharing those wants and desires with people around them? Or is this sort of like a place where they can come and be honest about their desires? I don't have a sense of what it would be like there. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think the society is one in which we talk openly about needs and wants. It is not something that is discussed openly, like I want this or I want that. Mm-hmm. And I always saw the tree as the place that they could manifest that desire, that wanting or yearning, you know. I kind of think of this, the tree, you know, it's about where your reality, you can yearn for a reality to be different from the current one that we are currently inhabiting. So that tree becomes like a place for yearning for what could be or what might have been, you know. In to me, that's how they see the tree in a weird way, because people don't talk openly about the fact that, oh, I'm dying to get married, or, oh, I wish I had a house, or, you know, maybe, or I wish I could have a baby. You know, it's not a common in conversation. We are private people. And also with Asian cultures, you know, there's a lot about like not being vulnerable, not revealing, like not losing face. That's a big thing, right? So it's part of the kind of cultural, I guess, landscape to not be so open about your feelings. I remember when I first came to the U.S., I was incredibly surprised about the things that people would tell you within 5 minutes of meeting you. You know, yeah. I was like, oh, I would never say that. but yeah, and we don't reveal things about our families or, you know, say things about our parents. It's a different kind of way of living, I guess. And so for me, the way those desires are manifested so openly at this tree, because it's anonymous. No one knows who tied that, you know, set of bangles to the tree, or who put up that house and who's yearning for a baby. No one knows. I mean, it's just, you know, it's done quietly, privately, maybe with a good friend, and then they're gone and it stays there and they hope that it gets to the gods, or at least in my imagination, I think they're hoping it gets to the gods. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say. I grew up in New England, and so I always thought we were pretty closed off about sharing our feelings or being open about those things, like you were saying. And then I moved to England, and I was like, oh, actually, we're pretty free with that stuff.
I know.
Yeah. So when I was sort of summarizing this piece to myself, you know, preparing for this podcast, I was thinking of it as a piece sort of about grief and loss, because that's definitely a part of it. But, you know, when I was rereading it, I didn't really feel that grief was like the central thing or the center of the piece. And it was this pull, this like attention to the act of wanting, like to the act of longing for something. And then I sort of got turned around and was like, isn't that kind of what grief is? Like grief is sort of wanting things to be different, or wanting to sort of change the ending. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that in terms of this piece or in general.
Yeah, you know, it's so strange what happens when you start writing, right? You start at one place and you end up at another place. Mm-hmm. And I started writing about the tree. You know, for me, I was just sort of thinking about my experience with the tree and the experience of how the villagers were experiencing the tree or interacting with the tree, and how far away it was from the way I saw the tree. And then, you know, then Sudha came into the piece, and because I had gone to see the tree with her, and then it suddenly it occurred to me that, oh, I'm finally able to write about her, and I'm writing about her from a place of longing to have her back in the world, you know, in just trying to make her come alive on the page. So I think it is in the end about grief, but it's so strange that I also felt so much joy from just bringing her back alive onto the page and, you know, sort of writing about her. So I think grief is very much a part of it, but it's also a kind of for me, it was coming to terms with that grief and sort of stepping away from it and looking at it and then being able to write, you know, all the different aspects of it, like basically the accident and then the just sort of looking at her as she had been alive in the world and then thinking of what could have been with her in the world, you know.
Yeah, I felt so much tenderness in this piece for Sudha, the moments of teasing that you have between the two of you, and these specific memories, you know, painting her toes and these details that just really bring her to life. But I was thinking, you know, I was, you know, putting myself in your shoes as a writer. Was it really difficult to decide which details to include? I mean, they must just come flooding back when you start writing something like this.
Yeah, you know, as I told you, I couldn't deal with the fact that she had died in this really horrific way.
Right. Yeah.
So I wouldn't think about it. And you know, bits and pieces of her would come back to me at like the oddest moments. They were so sensory, and I would hear her giggle in my ear. You know, she had the most amazing giggle. And then I would get like a sudden clear picture of her toes, like exactly what they look like. And then I would get the sound of her kitchen in my head, which is always one, because like crazy clutter and clatter, like very noisy, because she would just be like this like whirlwind in the kitchen. And so then I just started writing those bits and pieces of her that came to me. And, you know, the just basically then I could enter back into her, but in this kind of odd kind of way where there was just bits and pieces first and then I could
interrupt you. I'm so sorry. I just looked up and it says that you are offline, which is not a good sign.
Oh gosh. Okay.
I mean, the good news is it didn't say that like 2 minutes ago. So I think this is a very recent problem, but let me.
So I want to say that I avoided thinking about Sudha for the longest time because her, you know, the way she died was so horrific. And I wasn't even there. So all I had was these pictures in my head, which I didn't want to deal with. But as time passed, you know, at odd moments, her giggle would come back to me. She had like the greatest giggle. And I had a very I had a clear picture of her toes. I would see her like, you know, sort of walking across the fields to us. So it was weird. She came back to me in these bits and pieces. There were like a sense of like sound and visuals mostly. And it would be like the clatter of her kitchen and things like that. So, you know, when I could then deal with her, sort of started thinking about her again, then I decided to go all in, sort of just start thinking about her and, you know, sort of through that process, sort of put her back together onto the page kind of thing where, you know, sort of create a whole picture, not just these little kaleidoscopic bits that was happening before. So that's I think you know, the question is, how did I decide what memories to include? I think I decided that I would just put what came to me before into the piece because, and I also thought this is the way to bring her alive. Like, you know, you think about what parts of a character to include because even as if I'm writing from a place of emotion, I'm also a writer and I'm also writing from as someone who revises over and over again. And, and so then I started thinking, okay, as a character, how best to bring her out? What parts do you include, right? And I'm not one of those Dickensian writers who goes from top to bottom giving you a description. I want her to come alive in the bits that I give you. So that's how. And then, you know, I did write certain scenes out just for my own sake. And then what I do is I write the scene out in all its, you know, in length. And then I take everything out and just keep like the heart of that scene just because it's an essay, it's not fiction. And I'm not, you know, I just need to give you a glimpse of what it is like being her or being with her and then move out again into the heart, into what the essay is trying to say.
Mm. Yeah. It's great that you say that. Cause my next question was going to be about length. Cause I think, I don't know if it sounds funny to say this, but one of my favorite things about this piece is how short it is. It's sort of a brief piece. I think maybe 2,300 words. Mm-hmm. It feels like it just stays like just long enough in each section and each section feels very essential. You know, we get just enough of the tree and of Sudha and you know, your experience as the writer. And I was wondering if it had sort of come together as a short piece or if you had sort of carved it out of something longer, but it sounds like it was originally something longer.
I mean, longer in the sense for my revision sakes, but you know, it started, as I said, with 5 lines.
That's true.
Yeah. And I was just like, okay, I just need to get this on the page. I don't know what this is about. And I just started from there. And this is a lot of what my process is like. I usually just get like some kind of sentence just appears for me, you know, just it's always about the language and how that sentence works. And then I just start sort of following the sentence. Like I write the next sentence and the next sentence and the next sentence. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of just sort of weaving it, you know, in a weird way. And then when I think, oh, okay, here, I think I just write everything down, you know, sort of just like just throw everything onto the page and just let it sit there and see what happens. But this essay, weirdly, I always had the ending. You know, so I always had that ending of us sort of standing there and of me thinking about what could have been if she had lived, you know, that or what my wish for her would have been. That was always the ending. So I sort of had to bring the essay to that point. And I actually struggled trying to fill it in to make it longer because I was like, it was getting there pretty quickly. And I was like, actually, I need to go back and sort of think about how do I, you know, bring in all the stuff that I want to talk about, the sort of like the relationship to the tree and what trees mean in the culture and how I'm thinking of this as this axis mundi between the you know, the netherworld and the celestial world and all of that. So the essay keep wanting to end, and I don't know if that's just me, but I had to sort of stop the essay from like going too quickly towards the end and sort of slow it down and think about it for a longer period and then write out the middle bits much more, you know. So I had the beginning and the end, and it was the, I worked a lot on the beginning. I mean, on the middle, yeah.
Oh, that's really interesting to hear. I almost never have the problem of a piece being too short. They're always too long.
Yeah. I guess I could say I'm an economical writer in some ways, you know, so I have to sort of force myself to make them longer because I'm always trying to say, oh, do I really need to say this too, you know?
Yeah, it's funny that you say that. I think one of the most common edits that our nonfiction editor, Liz Witte, gives often to people is asking nonfiction writers to put a little more of themselves on the page and maybe like explain a little more or what their connection is or why they're writing this piece and that kind of thing. And I think, maybe there isn't as much of an instinct to sort of put yourself in there. But obviously with a piece like this, it's so personal. There was never any chance of it not feeling personal. Is there anything else you can tell us about your revision process, either for this piece or in general? You know, are there strategies that you give to your students when you're talking about revising?
Yeah, I mean, so for myself, you know, I'm always thinking in terms of vividness, you know, sort of like how vivid is this on the page? Can you see it? So a lot of my revision work or whatever would be like to take out all the extraneous kind of flabby bits or the adverbs, you know, things like that. I mean, the way I work is that the first draft is always the kitchen sink, you know, it's just like throw everything in there, throw everything that's coming to you. So that'll be like this huge mess. I mean, you know, I won't look at it. I'll just leave it alone. And that at that moment of the writing, when the, you know, you're just writing it, it's the high, it's like the joy, the mad love, right? You feel for your gorgeous sentences. Like you're so in love with the piece. You're like, oh my God, I am the most amazing writer in the world, you know? And so then I just like leave it there. I never look at it again for many months because I don't want to, because I know if I'm still in that, you know, mode of like, oh wow, this is so great kind of thing. And then you know, the revision is, you know, basically the cold hard look at the big mess you've made, right? So I think Chris Offutt calls it a cruel and ruthless objectivity. I just love that, you know. That kind of like, you know, it's like you have to sort of look at this dangerous love and see whether it's any good, you know, whether it's good for you or not kind of thing. And So I mean, my own process is I read the sentences aloud a lot. I think about structure. I think about POV, point of view. I think about scene. I'm always thinking about, is this draft like some self-indulgent kind of thing that is serving me, or is it serving the story? Right. So, you know, I had a teacher, Yale doctoral, the famous, amazing Yale doctoral, was my thesis advisor. And yes. And he, I have so many funny stories about him, but he said this amazing thing, which has really stuck with me. You know, he said, when you start reading and rereading your own writing, be conscious of where your eyes start rushing through the paragraph. And he said, that's where the problem is. You know, like you don't want to read, you're like, ah, this is, you know, so like basically if that's boring to you, it's boring to the reader. And I'm really, really conscious of that. Like I always read and reread. And I think of this as almost like a weird kind of process where I'll be like combing over, like I'm combing through and combing through and combing through. I take a long time to write my pieces. You know, they're not like sometimes some, you know, very, very rare occasions they arrive fully finished, but then that's really rare. But I take a long time to sort of go through and like I think of it as this weird like combing, you know, the image I have of it, these, it's so weird, but it's like these monkeys who look through each other's fur, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
I see myself like that, like going through the piece, you know. And anyway, so that's how I look at my own work. It's a very slow process, but it's also a process where I'm really, really looking at every paragraph and cutting out things that don't work. I think a cruel and ruthless objectivity. I've come to that because I'm like, okay, this piece is done. It's now like something that I need to shape. It's not me anymore. You know, is this character really speaking to people? I had to even make Sudha into a character. I mean, she's my beloved aunt who's no longer in the war, but you know, I had to make her into a character to make her be the person she is now in this essay.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. And with my students, you know, I repeat this till I think they're sick of me, you know, basically. I keep saying all writing is revision. All writing is revision. I mean, that is like the mantra that people need to have, because, you know, and students come into the classes thinking I've written this amazing piece. They're in that in love mode, you know. And so, and for me to stand there and say, okay, great, now let's take, this is a draft, you're in a process, it's always process writing, you know. So take it back and here's, you know, let's look at it again and again. And I do a lot of stuff with them to, so the way, I mean, just take a step back. I sort of teach from a place of like, that writing is a skill that can be taught. You know, I think it was David Bartholomew who said it's not a privilege of caste. Like, you know, that people think of writing as a privilege of caste, as like all the mythic things that people tell each other about. Oh, it just comes to me as an inspiration, this, that, and the other. And so I think for me, I always try to say that this is a skill that can be learned. And here are the techniques that you can use to make your writing better. You know, my whole approach is very, like, here are techniques. Let's peel back the back of the clock and look inside. And this is what was used to make this piece the way it looks. And you have access to these skills, you know. And I mean, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, at the end of the semester, their writing is so much better because they actually learned how to, you know, put those skills, best techniques into actually onto their own writing, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, I like that. It feels like a more optimistic way of thinking about writing than I think a lot of us writers turn out to be pessimists.
Yeah. but
it is something that you can sort of isolate and dissect. Mm-hmm. Even if that's not terribly romantic, it is true.
I know, it is not romantic, but the final piece is romantic. It's gorgeous because you did the work, you know?
Yeah.
There's like things like, you know, like sort of making them stop, like taking one line and saying, I do this thing called blow up, which is basically say, like, you know, if you have an emotion in a line, I'm like, okay, stop here. Now blow this up. You know, basically write more about this moment right here. Then let's like engage all the senses. Let's dig deep into what you are actually feeling. You know, how did the world look from that emotional point of view that at that moment? You know, so I make them do a lot of that kind of thing where, you know, where we identify where it could be blown up or where it could be shortened. Like, I don't need you to tell me how you took a taxi to the airport, you know. Let's just get to the airport. So there's a lot of those kinds of things that we do. It's very much a sense of like you need to get in there and sort of manipulate it all. You need to get in there and break it open and then put it back together again. And the more we do that, then they get used to that. You know, otherwise it's like, oh, my writing is untouchable. This gorgeous piece, I can never touch it. And then by the end of it, they're like revising on their own, which I love that.
Yeah. Oh, I love that idea of blowing it up. Yeah, that sounds so useful. I'm gonna have to try it. I was also kind of, I first met when I spoke to your MFA class at Brooklyn College, mm-hmm. and it was such a good time. I love doing that kind of thing. And I know that you've taught creative writing for many, many years. I was kind of wondering, what do you feel like your students are doing, like what the young people are writing now that feels sort of new and fresh or different to you? And also I was kind of wondering if there are certain things that they seem to struggle with, you know, like, kind of like the example you were just giving of sort of like, what do you feel like you have to push them on?
I mean, on revision, yes. And and also on being vulnerable on the page. You know, mm-hmm. there's a difference between kind of being, what can I say, like sentimental and then being vulnerable. So I feel like sometimes the writing gets to be very maudlin kind of, you know, because I mean, this generation is growing up on like television and screens and screens and screens. So they're mm-hmm. getting like a very mediated experience. And I kind of feel like sometimes that sort of just translates onto the page in a very kind of superficial way. And so I do think that sometimes I have to say like the forget all these words that you're using, you know, just sort of stop and think about how you are feeling, how emotion is manifested in your body, for instance. You know, there's a lot of that, right? Like think about how emotion is manifested in the body, that how violence feels in your body, or when you're watching violence, how it feels. Mm-hmm. Like be aware of what it's doing to you, or if you're feeling sad, what is it doing to you? So some of that is a kind of a deepening that needs to be done, I think. And so I think what's really fresh is how they are using language. It's really, really mm-hmm. interesting ways of using language. I mean, especially, the MFA students that I worked with, the class you came to, they were at an amazing level of mm-hmm. Like just sentence level is gorgeous, you know, but sometimes structure needs to be sort of overlaid on where all these sentences are going and what are they saying, that kind of thing. But I'm always fascinated by the kind of, I guess, the experiences that they are trying to bring to the page. Those are experiences that I may never have, right? Because I'm not their age and I'm not from where they're from. So yeah, there are interesting things. I think that the most interesting thing to me for me is what they're doing with language, actually, is the at the sentence level, there are some gorgeous things that they're doing.
Mm. I mean, I find that encouraging because I always feel that is the hardest part to teach, mm-hmm. or something that is so personal and comes so naturally from the person, you know, things like rhythm and sound, yeah. and that kind of thing. Yeah. So that's nice to hear. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Structure, you can teach them.
Yes, I know. It's structure. And also like a kind of creating an emotional complexity on the page is also something that, you know, we try to teach, but yeah.
Yeah, I feel like we are often giving notes when we're reading, you know, really fantastic submissions that they just, sometimes they're staying a little bit too much on the surface, which mm-hmm. kind of, I think kind of fits with what you're saying. And, yeah. and you just need a few moments, maybe a little more interiority or where can we go a little deeper on this and get a little closer to home? Yeah.
Yeah. And I also, I mean, I always feel that the emotional tenor of the piece is not palpable enough. It's not tangible. You know, I want to feel it in your bones kind of thing. You know, I want to see that, like the flesh and blood of it. I don't see that. Or sometimes you really have to push to get there. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I also read in your bio that you used to run Fordham University's summer study abroad program in London. Mm-hmm. And I think that sounds like so much fun. I mean, like I said, I went to London. I was a study abroad student many, many years ago. So I was just wondering if you could talk about what it was like running the program.
Yeah, I didn't. I was the writer in residence at okay. Fordham for 3 years. And as part of the writer in residence program, you were encouraged to take students to London. Oh my God, it was the best thing ever. I mean, because we had a unlimited cultural budget.
Oh, yes.
So I would just like have to find things to take them to and just, you know, just I would just throw myself into like the cultural offerings in London. It was so amazing because you had all the alternative theater and then you had the Globe and Shakespeare and then like, you know, on this, like all the stuff in South Bank, which was very, very different from what was happening in the mainstream theater. Mm-hmm. So I would just, we would go to so many performances and plays and walks. And I mean, I did so many fun things. Like, so we would read Oliver Twist. So I taught a course called Outsider in the City. It was about non-British writers or like outsider characters, you know, how they saw London. So I would teach Oliver Twist because, I mean, he's such an outsider too.
Right.
and then we would actually go to all the places with London walks that are mentioned in Oliver Twist. It was so amazing. And it, because you could sort of see Oliver disappearing into the streets and, you know, the people who were chasing him and all of that. It was really brilliant. I did so much of that stuff. It was great.
I mean, that was basically why I wanted to study abroad in London. I wanted to read a book that was written in London and was about London and then walk around and be like, this is where that happened.
Yes, it was so, so fun. And we would go, you know, there's a famous scene in Oliver Twist where the drovers bring the cows into this market, Sheffield, I think it's called Sheffield, market in London. And then they're, you know, they're selling their cows and then they go and they have breakfast. And and I think in one piece, he sells the wife also because he's fed up of the wife, like one of the drovers. But so we did all of that. Like we went there at 6 and then went and had the full English breakfast.
Oh, nice.
And had the Guinness. I mean, I not with my students, obviously, but, you know, but this it was incredible. It was so fun. It was really lovely. I mean, I got to know London so well. It's such a walking city. It's beautiful.
I find it to be just such a welcoming city. I love New York, but I you know, I don't know. Yeah, London just feels wide open in a way that
I really did love it. London. I mean, it was because I got to see it from a very, very different way of looking at things because, you know, I would take them to, what's it called, Brighton? You know, now I'm forgetting.
Like the coastal town?
To like the... like the black areas of the city, and sort of walk around and eat Jamaican food and listen to the Jamaican
music. Oh, maybe
music.
Brixton. Oh,
Brixton. Yes, yes. Brixton.
Yes, yeah.
It was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. It's a great place. So I was wondering just if you could tell us what you're working on now, what's next from you?
So I have, you know, the way I work, I have so many bits and pieces that are just, I'm working on simultaneously. Because as I said, I work very slowly. So I have a couple of things that I'm working on. One is a short story that is about a woman who sits set in Jackson Heights. And it's a woman who sees a man in the elevator and suddenly is struck by the revelation that he's the angel Jibril or Gabriel.
Right.
She's convinced that this bureaucratic looking man is actually the angel Gabriel. And so I'm sort of, I've been working on that story for a long time. And then what happens, right? When she's convinced that he's this, and maybe he is, and I'm never going to tell you whether he is or he's not. So I'm working on that. And then I've been working on a few essays and one essay that I'm working on. I don't know if that's an essay or it's like, I don't know what it is. It's like some weird piece. But it is basically about a man who's on the, it's the experience of someone watching their father die because he's under a DNR, you know, do not resuscitate.
Right. Yeah.
And just like that moment of what it means to be there as you watch your relative die. And it's sort of very rooted in the body, in both their bodies. I'm just writing that. That's another thing that I'm writing.
That sounds like very, very rich material. Yeah. Well, Mira Nair, thank you so much for joining us. It's been so, so great to talk with you. Really fun.
Yeah. Thank you, Emily, for having me.
Listeners, you can read Mira's essay and subscribe to the latest issue at thecommononline.org.